So I'm going to open the this committee meeting, the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology for February 9th. And welcome, everybody. What do we have today?
Certainly, Senator Riley, members of the committee. Today we have two primary agenda items. We have on the agenda in order, as posted, is an informational meeting. The state CIO will give a state information technology overview. Second on the posted agenda is a work session for introduction of committee measures. As we discussed, Senator Riley, perhaps we, in the interest of bring up the members and or efficiency, if we could do the work session first, mm-hmm. and then
perfect.
Get that order of business taken care of, then we can move to the informational meeting.
Okay, with that, I'm going to open a work session for the introduction of committee measures. And what do we have to vote on?
Certainly, Chair Riley, members of the committee. Today we have legislative concept 2860. I did post that this morning and sent an overview to each of your offices. Just a little bit of background. Since April of 2016, on behalf of this committee and the state CIO, myself and the state geographic information officer have been convening a 24-member multi-jurisdictional work group. The primary product of that work group is legislative concept 2860. At the highest level, this legislative concept establishes the Oregon Geographic Information Council within the office of the state CIO and specifies membership, purposes, and powers of this multi-jurisdictional council. Second, the concept requires public bodies beginning in 2020 to share certain geospatial framework data under specified conditions and with specific limitations. The core concept here is that the bill intends to form the multi-jurisdictional council first, give it time to form up, get its legs under it, establish any rules, policies, procedures, and standards, and then and only then will the information sharing, the mandatory information sharing on geospatial framework data begin. And so this multi-jurisdictional council will determine what data is to be shared, how often, and under what data standards. Third, the concept requires the state CIO to appoint a state geographic information officer to oversee and manage the state CIO's duties and functions under the provisions of the Act. The state geographic information officer will report to the state CIO, but will also support the council's activities. Fourth, the concept requires the state geographic information officer to secure the geospatial data library to protect the availability and integrity of the information that resides in the library and to provide secure electronic access to the library for purposes of sharing geospatial framework data across all public bodies in Oregon. And finally, the concept establishes an Oregon Geographic Information Council fund. Essentially, this is an account, a placeholder for existing monies that are allocated to the Office of the State CIO for this purpose, and perhaps others that the State CIO may attract, federal funds, federal grants, private donations, et cetera, for the purposes of carrying out the duties in the Act. So those are the primary functions of this legislative concept, and it is now ready potentially for a motion to introduce the concept as a JLCINT House bill.
Thank you, Sean. So as always, this is just to introduce a bill as a committee bill, and voting yes on it shows no intention on how you're going to vote later. It's just to introduce the bill. Representative Nathanson.
Mr. Chair, can I want to make sure I get the words right, dot the I's across the T's. I move to introduce LC 2860 as a JLCIMT House bill.
Thank you. Representative Nathanson has moved that we introduce LC 2860 as a JLCIMT House bill. Is there any discussion? Any objections? It's introduced. Thank you. I'm going to close that work session.
Mr. Chair, can I make a brief statement?
Yes, you may.
Wow, this was a long time coming, and I'm so pleased that after many months of stakeholders talking, people really rolled up their sleeves to come to an agreement on something that was kind of all over the place.
That's right.
Still is, but through this bill, it looks like there will be, if the bill passes through, we'll have a different and improved situation for the state. So anyway, congratulations to everyone who was involved, because it took a long time to get to this point.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Riley, just one last point. We're continuing to maintain our commitment to the work group. We plan to convene the 24-member work group sometime in the next month to have them, have a dedicated meeting on the introduced bill, to work with them on any appropriate amendments to the bill, and certainly we expect a number of them, to come for public hearings and work sessions we may hold in the future.
Good. Thank you. So I'm going to open an informational session here, and Sean, you want to fill us in on that?
Certainly. Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee, very glad that we have the state CIO, Alex Pettit, with us today. He is going to give a statewide information technology overview. As I mentioned in our meeting last week, this is the first of a number of overview presentations. We want to give the committee and those watching a very broad kind of understanding of what's going on, not only in the executive branch, which is the focus today, but also statewide in all branches. But Dr. Pettit, thank you very much for being with us, and if you could introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, my name is Alex Pettit. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the State of Oregon, and I appreciate this opportunity to present to you. This is for half of the committee now. This is going to be a lot of review stuff for those, for Senator DeBoer and Senator Lithicum. This will be new, but it'd be best for me, at least, if there's something as we're going through, if you all would ask me the questions in as I'm presenting, because I have a tendency sometimes to get ahead of myself, or as unbelievable as it may sound with this accent, to talk too fast. So don't hesitate to ask me to clarify something or slow down or what have you, and I'd appreciate it very much. All right. So this is going to be just an overview of the Office of the State Chief Information Officer. So last large session, we had the introduction of House Bill 3099. Prior to that, the state CIO's function was an oversight function. About 18 folks in the office of the state CIO, and we were policy, and then service delivery was performed by the Enterprise Technology Services that had the Technology Services Center, which were the folks that supported DAS IT, the things for DAS and DAS client agencies, as well as the security. Security was there wasn't a security group. It was everyone was in security, so consequently no one was in security. So that's kind of how that went. After 3099, the Office of the State CIO assumed responsibility for those utility services, which I'll get into in a little bit, established the independence and accountability of the state CIO, joint authority over statewide policy and infrastructure services for delivery. We established the stage gate process, where we had a ready, set, go, and we'll go into more detail on that, how we manage projects of over $1 million. And independent procurement oversight and contract enforcement authority gave us standing in IT, major IT contracts, something we didn't have before. So really transformed us to being, instead of just an oversight group, to being delivery of utility services and oversight and some control over the project execution, large project execution. So we're like everyone else, I suppose, but, you know, we're customer-centered. We focus on delivering value. We focus on being a partner, and we try to bring innovation to the state. That's really our hope, is that we can mature enterprise technology governance, leverage investments and shared services, ensure transparency, provide oversight, and deliver secure and innovative solutions. So to that, what we've done is we've organized our group into, I'd say, four major buckets there, the blue ones, the ETS, Enterprise Technology Services, that's our core compute and, you know, compute and storage and those things, the state data center, I guess is how I would describe that. We have the Enterprise Security Office, which we formed, that has right now about 24 folks in it that are dedicated security people that focus on security for those services that are housed at the state data center. We have the strategic IT governance, which oversees the IT project and project management for the, so it's the oversight group for managing and coordinating projects, major projects and agencies. And then we've got the shared services group, where we've primarily focused right now on vendor management, e-government, our QA contracts, GEO, as Mr. McSpadden spoke of, transparency, and our state interoperability. A dotted line to the DAS IT that's remained within DAS, so they're the end user support, the application development that's specific to DAS, those things that are DAS purpose type solutions. So just like any other agency, DAS has their own IT group, just like ODOT has an IT group, just like DHS has an IT group, and so on. All right, so IT finance next. We get asked often about this, so I wanted to just go ahead and bring in here your kind of my trial run before I bring it to Ways and Means in a week. So as you see, by and large, you know, our personal services have remained flat. Our services and supplies budgets remain, you know, it's gone up and then flattened out. And then our capital outlay has increased over the last couple of years. That's for new equipment that we bring in as the capital outlay that we've had. You know, it's hovered right around $150 million. So for the last 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 biennium. So that's really a pretty fair representation of where we've been. If we were to look at it in terms of, this is like kind of a simplification of what we would call a sources and uses statement, right? So this is our revenue is the dark green. Light green is the revenue, and the dark green is what we've actually spent on. Well, let's get rid of that. Get out of there. Come on. Sorry about that. Hang here. I am. We go up and down. Let's see if I get there. Nope. I'm trying. There we go. That's cooperating now. So as you see, we've had our revenue has outrun our expenditures, you know. So we collect more than we bring in. A lot of that expenditure has gone to other things, you know. It's gone to, when we've reorganized the office of the state CIO, we pulled apart the security folks. Some money was taken out, and people were taken out specifically dedicated to security and so on. So that's where those. But this is our sources and uses, if you like, statement, you know. So. You know, and again, that reflects how, you know, that's about where that $150 million, when we talk about what we're doing, that's what that's reflective of there, you know, is that's what we're spending on IT in the state and the SDC. I'm not going to use that thing again. Get out of there. All right, so, but overall, no, come on. Overall, so even though our spending, and we go back to 2003, I call that, you know, our 2003, 2005 actuals, that's kind of a, you know, our best fitting line. Okay, I'm going to become the statistician here a little bit, you know, being the PhD, this will happen to you. The best fitting line isn't quite flat. It shows increased rate at a flat rate. But if I were to remove that anomalous point there, that first point, it would be almost horizontal. But if you look at the overall, and this is non-personnel statewide IT spending. This is what we're spending on everything except people across the state. So, you know, that was the easiest thing that we could pull because it's out of the, we got the account numbers we can pull it from. So as you see, non-personnel spendings remained pretty flat for that, but it's been increasing. at a pretty steady rate. You know, that's a pretty well-fitting line there, you know, as far as it goes. It's gone up at a predictable rate and continues to do so. Okay. So what is driving that increase, I guess? You know, that would be my question. What is my cost driver to that? Well, if you look at that, I don't know what color you call that. I call it red. I don't know what you all would call it. That red thing there, that represents outsourcing and contracting. So outsourcing and contracting over the past 5 biennium, 6 biennium, I guess, has been increasing at an increasing rate. Okay, that's the cost driver that we see for IT has been for contracting and outsourcing. That's not surprising, but that's where it's coming from. You know, so that's what we see as the trend, and we would expect that to continue as we go forward. All right, and then this is just. So this is a harder slide to explain. This is the color of money slide, all right? So, you know, when we talk about, you know, where we're spending money from, federal monies have become an increasing portion of what we spend on IT. The general fund dollars have ebbed and flowed, but by and large have remained pretty much the same. Other funds is another large source, obviously, of funding, and then lottery funds is that little bitty sliver that you see a color, you know, on that just barely comes through some years. So, but federal funds are becoming more and more important to us as we go forward. All right. Okay. So on this thing here, this is a little more involved discussion. So when the state data center, ETS, whatever we want to call it, was built, with 16,000 square feet, but they only put power to half of it. All right. So if you think about it, you bought a big house, but you didn't run the electrical to half of the house, right? You know, you just didn't power it up. Well, that's fundamentally what we've got at the data center. We've got about half of it has space that we can use. The other half we're unable to use at this time because you can't stand up equipment where there's no power. So That's been a limiting factor for us as we've been going forward with the state data center. As we engage prospective clients, as we engage prospective customers, one of the things that drives us is having to stay under what we call our power threshold. So being aware of it, getting equipment in, and then transforming it to more power efficient equipment has been something we've had to do over the years just to stay under that power, that ceiling. And that's limited what we've been able to provide to our customers. So it was designed for the future capacity. So, you know, we got a couple pictures here. The reinforced floor was built for another power distribution unit. We got space for another UPS, uninterruptible power supply. You know, we may go with what they call what was that thing? The spinning magnets. I can't think of the name of it now. So I'm getting bad about this. But instead of going with batteries, we may look at other power options. UPSs tend to be bad because you need chemicals and whatever. They got other things now that allow the thing to cut over that don't require any batteries. And then we got a space for another generator, another pad for another generator there. So we have the, without any additional floor changes, constructing any, we could light the rest of the floor is what we're saying. It just takes the equipment to do it. So, and as you see, we got about 106 data centers. Now, we use that term very loosely. Some data centers are a closet with a server in it. Other ones are full raised floor and Halon, and or not Halon anymore, whatever, you know, the fire suppressant is, and the chillers and all that kind of stuff, Lieberts and such. 2,024 servers are supported by agencies outside of ETS. Non-ETS data center operations are consuming roughly 18,000 square feet, and we're using third-party data centers in some cases, and that's accelerating. So what we found is that we have a lot of folks that are using, that have had to use because they haven't been able to get capital outlay to build their own data center, so they're using other data center providers, other facilities for that. In some cases, they're going through us, in other cases, not so much. So that's been one of those things that we're aware of. The blue dots are those folks that are under OSCIO authority, and then the two yellow ones there are the ones that are not. So, I can't pick the...
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we, and I use that term very loosely, we, in any of the agencies in state government, contract for data center services, is that generally something that we're purchasing through an Oregon business or an out-of-state service?
Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, thank you for the question. Yes, it's been primarily through, so the contract that we hold is with a company called Atmosera. They used to be a company called, gosh, I can't think of their previous
name. It was Easy Street.
Easy Street was their previous name. They're a Portland-based company. We do have their, we do use their services for our overflow when there's something that's coming to the data center that overflows. I cannot speak to those other, to the other contracts. We also have a mutual aid agreement with the state of Montana. So we have floor space in Helena, which is which is their data center location, and we swap back and forth with them. They use some of our data space, our data floor space for their disaster recovery. We have floor space over there. We've looked at expanding that for the purpose of assuming bringing some of this back into the state, or at least under state control. But currently, I can't answer the question directly that you're asking. I could find out for you, however.
It's not necessary right now, and thank you for the information you did provide.
Sure. Thank you for the question. So a number of agencies have started working with ETS to migrate their managed computing data storage and networking to SDC, including Dogami, State Library, Youth Authority, PERS, OSMB, Public Health, and so on. What I would offer is we've had many other agencies approach us if we could offer them co-location facility. If we could stand up cages and just power them and let them run their own systems and their own services however they wanted to, but they would not have to continue to make investments in their own systems, in their cooling and security and power and all those kinds of things. But again, we're at the limit of our capacity at the moment. Our electrical capacity. We're at the limit of our electrical capacity in the data center. We're not at the limit of our physical capacity. Again, if you were to go through the data center, you'd see half of the floor is open. So,
what's the cost associated with bringing in that second power plant?
Well, we looked at that, and I'll skip ahead to them there to answer that question, Senator. At this time, the estimated one-time capital costs are between $13 and $18 million at the moment. That's what this would run. And then this is the listing of all the stuff that would be associated with it. What we're looking to do, I'm sorry, I missed my address. Senator Riley, Senator Linthicum, thank you for the question. What we're looking to do here is do this like the old Johnny Cash song about how he built himself a Cadillac by taking one piece at a time. So we're going to try to do this one piece at a time and then assemble this over the course of the next couple, 3-4 years if we can. So as I'm able to free money up, as I'm able to get things, I'm gonna buy one piece and bring it in and another piece and bring it in and see if I can, over a period of time, electrify the rest of the data center. That's my commitment to you, sir.
Senator Lithing, do you like a follow-up?
No, I don't have a follow-up at this time.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will add a follow-up then. I appreciate your asking about this. What are the costs that we avoid or the offsets? If this investment is made, there must be some offset you can describe, or is it even potentially profit center is probably the wrong term, but is it a resource then that can be leased and charged to other entities?
Senator Riley, Representative Nathanson, thank you for the question. Yes, this would be something that we would be, so we would look at, we believe many of this, many of the existing data centers, and we have been told anecdotally by many CIOs of the agencies that the care and feeding, the housing of their own equipment is something that they would like to get out of having to do. This is, and not even go to the managed service, just have the cages where their equipment could reside and they can manage it themselves. We would hope, and again, this is just kind of a rough estimate, we believe we'll be able to subsume the vast majority, if not all, of those 106 data centers. So in my previous assignment, we were able to bring in 72 data centers into a single data center that's roughly the same size as what the state data center has. Some of those were co-locations, some of those were managed services. That would be our, as we understand it, that would be attractive to the folks that, that are out there running their own systems, many of the folks, because it would, but we're talking cost avoidance as much as we are anything else. So instead of having to replace a battery or replace a generator or replace a chiller or something like that or an air handler, I don't have a figure for that. We can certainly work on that for you if the committee would like to see that, but those are all, 106 batteries is a lot of batteries.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I might, whether this committee wants to pursue it or not, I would suppose a Ways and Means Subcommittee would ask for those kinds of numbers.
Yes, ma'am.
You know, we like to be sure the investment is worthwhile for an, in a number of ways, and some of it is just straight money. So it, if you find out that some of those agencies were within a couple of years or 5 or 6 years of replacing that is some costly piece of equipment, it doesn't take long to add that up if they already know it.
Yes, ma'am.
So if you can get that information to all of us through staff, that would be great.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. We certainly will.
Yes, Senator.
A follow-on, Mr. Chair. If it, not only in terms of dollars, but to collapse 106 data centers, it seems like there would be the personnel costs would also, you'd also be able to leverage that. And then my next question is in terms of the 2000, 2024 servers that are out there. How many of those are in a virtual environment? Are those standalone boxes? Are those virtual servers? How many of those can you collapse into a virtual environment and not only get leverage on the physical space, but on the staffing and on the number of servers that have to be maintained in the virtual world?
Chair Riley, Senator Lithicum, thank you for the question. It would depend if they go with a co-location model or if they go with the managed services model. Right now, if they were to go with a co-location model, those are single dedicated devices doing a single dedicated purpose. And in that event, they would not be, so they're not virtualized is what I'm
right,
trying to lead
right.
you to.
I recognize.
And so if it's simply a co-location where I set up a cage and they stand their equipment up in it, the net effect is a cost avoidance for sustaining the environments that they have. If, however, they go to a managed service, then you are talking about virtualizing those things and potentially reducing the power consumption, the people consumption, the management, and what have you. That would be a different discussion. But right now, the way that we're set up, we would be the utility service provider. I would view it as progress to simply get them all into the central data center and get that replicated to Helena and be able to say that we have everything, but you know, DR'd and everything. The folks that they have, these 106 data centers, I know I'm getting out a little, I'm outrunning my headlights a little bit here, but I would estimate or I would guess that none of them have facilities people, dedicated facilities people doing this. So their personnel costs would they would still be the server managers and the application managers and those folks. So they wouldn't lose any of those. They wouldn't get rid of any of those because it just facilities is something they pick up probably as a contract or as something that they have to do in addition to other things. So I'm but we will certainly research it and get it back to you. But we're really if we're only talking co-location, then we're really only talking about facilities folks, and there's not a whole lot of those running around the state.
Okay.
So, but thank you for the question. All right. And then, of course, all the another one was that third-party data center cost. Those would be things that we would look directly. Now, that would be a cost reduction. That is a good point that I should have emphasized there is those third-party data costs. Those are real costs. They're going out to us, from us. We wouldn't eliminate them, but as you can see, in 2016, they jumped to $1.7 million. That's a significant run rate there that we've got in that biennium. So,
John, did you want to?
Sure. Just a very quick point, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee. The catch-22 that currently exists is, you know, one that involves near at power capacity in the state data center, which prevents an easy move of agencies into the data center. At the same time, agencies have facilities, computer rooms, server closets, et cetera, in their own buildings. They weren't built as data centers, and when they come forward and ask for capital financing or dedicated funding to upgrade those facilities, replace them, I think, in the interest of transparency, the Legislative Fiscal Office sets a very high bar in regard to whether or not that really makes sense in this day and age with the services that are available in the data center or in a third party for a one-to-one replacement to occur. And so, at some point, something is going to have to be done here because again, I don't see us see it being a good situation to perpetuate 106 computer rooms out in the agencies. At the same time, there's a significant capital investment that may be required at the data center. So,
in addition to the fact of physical security,
yeah, absolutely, and disaster recovery.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Yeah. Absolutely, clearly.
Would you like
a follow-on,
Senator Linthicum?
To the other
Senator
chart,
Linthicum,
yes.
Excuse me. If you could go through the chair, that would be great.
You betcha.
Would you like a question?
May I?
Yes, please.
Thank you. The other chart that you referenced, where we see the 1.7 expanding there, I'll assume the 2017 number is just January, and that would be close to 720, 700 for the year, which isn't too far out of line for if I were to be the statistician that you were referring to. We draw a line from the 550 into a 600 into a 720, and it would look like a very gentle line. What caused the spike to 1.8?
Chair Riley, Senator Linthicum, thank you for the question. The spike was driven by a variety of things. One of them was flat, the data center running out of space. So the Department of Justice's child support system, we had to push that to Atmosfera. That's a large system that's going up right now. We subsumed the responsibility for Cover Oregon into DCBS, and that was an entirely outsourced system, and now it has been transformed into being an on-premise supported system. So we've done that. That was what a large part of that. We had to sustain that system out with Oracle Managed Cloud Services for a year, and I was a part of that, so I'm very familiar with that, and can answer anything you'd like to know about that. We had no choice though but to keep that external to us, and now we've brought that system in house. That's the one system it's called, and so that's determination for eligibility for Medicaid. That's housed at the state data center now. So that's one of the reasons the cost will be down, is because we were able to internalize that rather than it being externally hosted. But There were other driving factors to that as well. I would probably have to say that the Oracle system for doing DCBSs for the year that they did eligibility determination, them and OHA, that system was, that was a lot of money to us. So
thank you. Go ahead.
All right, so Enterprise Asset Management, ETS, we've worked through with the architects to develop specifications, detailed cost estimates, and proposed timeline. And so I went through that already. Absent additional data center capacity, IT infrastructure will either need to remain within the existing agency facilities or relocated using third-party data center space using brokered agreements. Underutilizing that, well, we'll continue to have about 8,000 square feet we can't use, give or take. All right. Okay, so you all, we go through this often, this enterprise IT governance model. Utility services at the bottom, those are the things that are common to everyone. Nicholas Carr in 2004 in the Harvard Business Review called these the differences that don't make a difference, you know, the dial tone, the mega memory, the CPU, the trace route, all the things that only IT people could possibly care about, the end users will never care about. You know, they just know if it's there or if it's not there. So that's under the state CIO's authority. We're the group that delivers those services through ETS, and we're managed by a customer utility board that sets the rates for that and sets the services for that and determines what is or isn't a utility service. The next layer is the shared services. Those are managed by the state CIO's office has a shared business segment director. Those are things that we're working primarily on procurement and vendor management right now. There are other services that may fall into that category. They've not been developed as fully as we would like to see them thus far. The classic example of that from my previous life was case management. When I was with the state of Oklahoma, we had a unified case management system for public safety. So from Oklahoma Highway Patrol all the way through to pardon and parole, they had one. Through the AG's office, through everybody, they had one case, you know, and they had one system that managed it all the way through. And they managed it as a shared service. And then at the top are the unique agency functions, those things that are specific to the mission and the delivery of the services that are unique to the agency. So nobody else does the delivery of Oregon Health Plan except OHA, you know. So what we would call a bespoke solution, something that is unique to the agency, a service that only they would provide and something that they maintain, and that's strategically important to them to achieve their mission. All right. So there's only four things we do in IT. You know, we consult, we design, we build, and we run. That's all we do. You know, that's all the IT profession in a nutshell right there. So if you look at what the different groups do, the strategic technology officers are involved in the consultation or in the description of the problem. What's the problem we're trying to solve? What is it you're trying to do? And when they come forward here in the next few weeks and present to you the information resource management plans, IRMs, for each of their policy areas, that'll hopefully bring more light as to what it is we mean by that consult and design component for that. After that, we get into design and run. That's the stage gate piece, and that's actually a joint approval between us and the Legislative Fiscal Office. And in that, that's the analyst, though, for us. That's our analysts, our IT analysts that we have that manage and oversee the projects as they work themselves through the stage gate process. And then at the end, you've got, and then that's on either side, you've got enterprise IT governance. And then you've got, at the end of it, the run pieces, the enterprise portfolio, the shared services portfolio, the agency portfolio. So that's the last component. Those things reside with the agencies, the agency portfolios. So we got our six strategic technology officers, and they'll be coming up to you in the next couple of weeks. education, healthcare, natural resources, administrative boards and commissions, public safety, and transportation and economic development. So these are the people I'm not going to talk a whole lot about them. I'll let them talk about themselves when they get here in a week or two. All right. So we got in the our strategic initiatives here, I guess I would call them, and our IRM process. We have our one of the biggest things we've brought so far to the we've been able to work through with the state has been the stage gate process, putting a discipline around how projects work through the system. So linking incremental funding to IT projects to specific performance targets or stage gates. Prior to that, funding was given to an agency for an entire project at a time. So whether it was planning or in consulting, whether it was in design, whether it was in execution, they got all the money and then they'd come back as they needed to for things. We've changed that now to where it's associated with the achievement of certain deliverables. The project and portfolio management tool gives us access to real-time data on the enterprise. Service review, reducing system duplication, identifying opportunities for shared services, and then enterprise architecture, aligning the business processes and IT investments to better serve the citizens of Oregon. We haven't done enough in enterprise architecture, very candidly. We're still trying to get our arms around just the things that are in flight and the projects that are going on and what's been happening. So we haven't very many comprehensive architectural designs yet. This is a very busy slide. The only reason I bring it up is just to illustrate there are a number of artifacts under each of these stages. So our concept phase, our early phase, pre-stage one approval, any or all of these may be asked for. So trying to figure out, you know, what it is they're trying to get done, what problem they're trying to solve, and how does technology help to solve it or not solve it, the articulation of
Dr.
it.
Dr. Pettit, there is a larger fold out of this. I wonder if you could get that to our new members.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to. Okay.
Coach O'Reilly, as this is a joint process, and we developed the document together, I can get that all to you.
Thank you.
I'll work with you.
Okay, very good. We can print those off in A-size paper for you. Yes, sir. And again, I mean us in the Legislative Fiscal Office, we go through and we identify or articulate which of these artifacts are going to be required, which of these artifacts are not going to be required, which additional artifacts could be required. So basically the concept phase up to stage one, a plus or minus 50% plan to stage two, a plus or minus 10% plan to stage three, and then execution after that. And then going through, and that's a racetrack that we run around until the project is completed to just do updates and figure out where we are. It doesn't, one of my favorite things I like to say, unfortunately, you know, IT is a discipline of failure. We do things, it doesn't work, we try something else, it doesn't work. So all this does is it does not ensure success. It ensures that we will fail fast and fail small. That's all we're trying to do. And the faster that we fail, the sooner we can redirect and get on to the right thing that we should be doing. That's all at this point is.
That's very good.
All right. So determination of business need, detailed business case, scoping requirements, and alternatives. We do a fit gap there, an enterprise fit gap at stage two. That means do we have another solution that would fit this? So as an example, where we got the Oracle EULA, that unlimited license agreement. Is someone identified a problem or a need of the business they're trying to fulfill that's something we already have would fulfill it? And if we do, we use what we got. If we don't, then we continue on. Then we go into detail planning, and then all the execution after stage three. So ready, set, go. That's really a high-level simplification of the model. All right, this is kind of where we are in time and space today. So we've got, and when I say 18 non-stage gate projects, I mean we're monitoring 18 projects that don't fall, that are under $1 million, and for whatever other reason, you know, they don't meet the qualifications for stage gate. But we're still monitoring them. We're still aware of them. We're still keeping track of them. We're just not forcing them through the formal methodology for, you know, stage gate. We got 11 in stage one, a couple of them in stage two, 18 in stage three, 15 in stage four, and then broken down by policy area. Transportation is got the greatest number of projects in stage gate. You'll be hearing more about those projects, the DMV modernization project, or some of the other projects here as this committee meets. Human Services has 15 next, and then Administrative and Business Services after that. So, and we kind of have a decomposition there at the bottom. Nobody's got, you know, there's a lot of projects that are going on. When I first came here, there were not very many that we were watching over, like
Representative Nathanson.
So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
I liked the simplification, ready, set, go. So on the part of it, are you ready? Do you know what you're doing? Do you know what you think you need? And did you even analyze your problem right? There are agencies that have projects that are going to be less than $1 million, but they can't afford to make a $400,000 mistake, for example. Wow. What capacity do you have to provide advice if there were an agency that, instead of feeling like they were being imposed on, that they were being made to go through stage gate, what if they actually wanted to know that they needed confirmation or some sort of like a friendly voice to look over it and say, yes, this looks right, or I think you've forgotten to take this other thing into account? Can your office help, or do they need to contract with you for that advice, like someone contracts with Department of Justice for legal advice?
So, Chair Riley, Representative Nathanson, thank you for the question. No, there's no charge or contracting. We do offer help whenever they'll take it. It's more often, in all candidness, we've had quite the reverse happen to us, where we've had projects that we felt were very significant for a variety of reasons that the agency did not feel should be under the scrutiny of stage gate, and we have asked that, or we have required them, and it's within our authority to require them to have them go through the stage gate. We've not had any project come to us where it hasn't met the requirement, where they've asked to be under that. We would certainly be we offer them help whether they like us or not, you know. So that's that 18 that's there that we're going through and monitoring, and we've not forced it into stage gate for those 18, but we are aware of them, and we're asking them to go through the same process, and we work very closely with them to try to help them, because it is helpful if you know what it is you're trying to do. There's not a lot of these projects can become rat holes in a hurry that you just put money down. So we are still in the process. I would say the stage gate process is only 3 years old, maybe, that we've established this. I would say that we now have all in-flight projects at least gated to some place, but not all in-flight projects have actually passed their next gate.
Mm-hmm. Sean, did you have something to add?
Chair Riley, members of the committee, just very briefly, the state policy that the state CIO promulgated for the executive branch requires any project that exceeds $150,000 to submit documents, including a business case and some preliminary plans, to the state CIO's office and request state CIO approval to move forward with a procurement. That's kind of the basic requirement for projects. The very large ones above $1 million that have other characteristics of high risk, complexity, then are put through the stage gate review process by both of our offices. Certainly the legislature itself, through the Ways and Means process, budget notes, through working with the Legislative Fiscal Office, you all have an ability to require some additional oversight, whether or not it's required by the executive branch policy. So,
okay.
In any case.
Senator Lithgow.
Yeah.
Just to follow on, in line of that, does the stage gate process bring overhead in terms of either dollars? It increases spending because of the higher scrutiny and level of requirements, or in terms of time, because now there's added staff coming up to speed, understanding the problem, analyzing the problem, et cetera, and you know what those numbers might look like?
Chair Riley, Senator Lithicum, thank you for the question. Yes, there are. I would opine that it would depend who you asked. If you asked the agencies, then they will say, yes, this is an additional burden, an additional overhead, an additional requirement. If you were to ask me, I would say that it prevents us from going in. It gives you better information than you had. There was a specific project, I will not mention the agency, that had come forward for funding, asking for $2.5 million to fund a project. And we had asked for further elaboration of that project. It was a project that was already in flight when we were just establishing StageGate. That number ballooned after they did the full, what we call elaboration of the requirements and everything was going to take, it ballooned to a $5 million cost. Now, they represented, it was my understanding, it had been represented by some folks there from that was due to StageGate. Well, my take was, well, just give them the $2.5 million and make them make up the difference that they can't get to for the pieces of the project they couldn't complete. So I was willing to take that bet. Finding out for leadership to be able to make a good decision on return on investment of a project, you've got to know the full cost of the project. You've got to get to a 10% plan. Otherwise, I would submit to you, it's a shot in the dark. You don't really know what that full true cost is going to be, and how is it fair for you to make a decision on something that you don't really know what your full costs are. So from where I'm sitting and my recommendation as the chief information officer, I don't see an option around it, you know, except to do this. I understand the concerns and I've heard those things expressed. I guess my comeback is, you know, it's just too risky. Otherwise, we've had too many very large projects go off the rails here in the state, a disproportionate number.
Right, and if I may, and Rips, your name, I'll get to you because I know you want to say something about this too. But the fact is, in my opinion, and I've done this for years and years and years, it's the problem of not doing all these plannings is twofold. One, either you're going to fail because you didn't figure everything out and you're going to fail, or you're going to balloon that program. You're going to say, oh, I forgot this, and now we have to add budget. And those are the things that almost always happen in large projects if you don't do sufficient planning. Representative Nierman?
Thank you. And I didn't even ask to ask a question.
I know.
But you read my mind,
yes,
correctly. So one of the things, and I think I brought this up last session too, is you know, I used to work in the private sector, and we had a stage gate process, and we didn't call it that, but it was the same thing. And it was as a person who was I was the agency back then, and I kind of felt it was kind of burdensome. Sometimes I had to jump through these hoops, and then they haul me into these conference rooms, and I have to be a subject matter expert on things, all that. And I had a little bit of a bad attitude towards it, and so I get that part of it. But as time went on, I started to see how that these things, that the stage gate process, or they called it the passport process where I worked, was actually crafting a very complex mechanism into something that could be successful on its own. And so I got to respect the process quite a bit. I did almost 180 degree turnaround on that. So I'm really a big fan of the stage gate process and that kind of planning there. And I'll quote you on something that you just said here. You said, how can you make a decision when you don't know what the full costs are? And you're not the driver for this, so I'll ask you to just kind of comment on it. But I think that I'll just come out and say, I think we fund things at the wrong time in the stage gate process. So I forget the exact numbers that you use. You say, like, stage gate one is 50% and stage gate two is 10% or something like that. I think we have these agencies come to us when they've only completed stage one and ask for funding. And I'm concerned about how that dovetails with the procurement process there. So So we have an agency. I'll just kind of put an example out. We have an agency that will come up and ask for money, and I'll ask questions. Say, are you going to do this in house? Are you going to contract it out? Are you going to do a off the shelf thing? And they say, well, we don't know. We haven't done that level of planning yet. And I'll say, well, what are you doing before this committee? I'm not that bold. I don't talk like that. But I'm thinking that. And they'll say, and we need $20 million or something like that. I say, you don't even know if you're going to do it in-house or if you're going to do it off the shelf or anything. How can you possibly even ask for that amount of money? And why at this point of the game would you ask for a dollar amount? I'm not an expert on procurement, and I'm trying to get up to speed, but I would think that part of the procurement process would be the state would go to the marketplace and say, we have Project X, and here's the specs on Project X. What can you do it for? And that guy will do it for $20 million, and that guy will do it for $22 million, but that guy will do it for $16 million. And there might be reasons to take the low bid or the high bid, but when we say, okay, we have approved $20 million for this project, we've put ourselves into a box that the lowest bid would be foolhardy to come out lower than $20 million. So I'm wondering if you can comment on that, about maybe having the procurement process take place, the appropriation process take place later in the stage gate process. Can you comment on that?
Chair Riley, Representative Nearman, thank you for the question. Yes, I'm happy to, particularly with a member of the Ways and Means Committee with us here. This is partially the vagaries of the Oregon state budgeting process. So what happens is every biennium, agencies come forward for a two-year budget. They get asked for this much over 2 years. So that's why you're seeing some of these projects come forward, and they intend to perform them or work them over the next 2 years, rather than coming forward to an emergency board hearing or somewhere else. They ask for that limitation or that funding to be built in on the biennium. After that, they have to come. Now, the thing that the stage gate has done, and I'm much less of an expert in this than our colleagues in LFO are, but what StageGate has done is it said, all right, we'll give you the first dollop of that amount of money to go and do that plan, and then the next piece to do the next plan, and so on. So in often what has happened is by controlling the limitation that they're able to expend to, we've been able to control that's really what those gates represent. Each gate represents the next dollop or the next iteration, the next hurdle of funding that they're given as part of that. Okay, you've received stage gate one. They come before often an e-board. They ask for the next limitation allotment to move right to stage gate two, to begin working on the parts for stage gate two, and so on. So it has been transformative. I don't know. I would offer that the stage gate is a creature as much of the vagaries of the way that the state of Oregon does budgeting. I don't think it's a, I think it has been a good marriage between what our discipline needs and what the state is, how the state operates. But if we were to burn the whole thing down and say there'd be another way to fund these, well, I'd be open to that too. So,
so if I understand what you just said, and maybe you two can correct me, is what we do is we budget, but we limit how much of that can be spent. We don't authorize all of that budget to be spent right away. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. That is correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So reacting to that, I am recalling, though, that Representative Nearman did raise a point. It's a signal to the market that you're willing to spend up to that much. Mm-hmm. So that raises a question for me. It's worth a conversation. Also, as you were asking the question, and as the director was responding, it, even though purchasing and implementing a software project is not the same as a capital construction project, there is some similarity, and you have to spend some money on architects and engineers hire someone to do some soil analysis. There are things you do, and then you have to authorize spending a little bit to figure out what you've got, what you think you need, and what you didn't know was once you dig more than 2 feet under there, what you're going to find that may need cleaning up. And then that helps you refine your project or say, well, never mind, we have to go do it somewhere else. And that, too, does go through iterations of developing the project, but also through different points of allocating funds. It's not just, oh, here's a bunch of money and good luck. That's not going to work either.
Can I follow real quick? Very quickly. I want to move on, but go ahead.
And we tried to do that. Your analogy is apt, though, of that you got to do some soil analysis, all that, and then you dig stuff up, and it's not what you expected, and you get that with software projects. But we kind of tried to do this a little bit with the DMV Service Transformation Project. The precursor of this committee tried to unschedule the funds, and I think full Ways and Means had other ideas or whatever. But anyway, I hope that's something that we can look at as a committee to see if we can do the funding a little bit farther down the stage gate process.
Okay. That's what we're looking at. So, Dr. Pettit, if you'd like to go ahead.
Thank you. All right, so let's do an overview of the security thing. So, much like our evolution in IT overall, we've had an evolution in security. So, back in 2015, we had the transfer of authority from the State Data Center over to my office for security. Then we immediately did Microsoft did a security risk assessment, and we've been working that ever since. You know, all the things that Microsoft went through and found at the data center there. 3099 was implemented, and ESO was formalized. We received the grant from the National Governors Association from the Policy Academy on cybersecurity. That's applying a healthcare model to cybersecurity, meaning that if one of us is sick, we're all sick, you know. And there's different aspects to being, you know, there's inoculation, there's hygiene, there's the response and care treatment component. So we've got a lot of stuff that we've worked on with that. Senator Riley was good to attend the workshop that we had there in, I guess it was October, November. We've got another one coming up again now with NGA, and we'll be presenting in San Jose on some of the things that we've developed. And then unification of cybersecurity is Senate Bill 90. That's right now in the Senate Committee over there. And then we've had a variety of Secretary of State audits that have come. So from a high level, that's really what we've been experiencing there is kind of a timeline thing. So information security assessments ongoing. Enterprise security plan should be done middle of this year based upon assessment results. So part of the executive order that we got was that one of the things we did with the executive order by having all of the security people in the 84 agencies report to the state CIO, it's given us the opportunity to do assessments, perimeter assessments, internal assessments, and overall security risk assessments. We've gotten a lot more cooperation than we have in the past. We're coming up with much better information. From the few that we've completed, we found I would say a handful of what would be described as significant security issues that were perimeter related. So we were able to identify them, address them, and get them closed. So those were good. I'll give you a fuller report on that at a later date after we've walked the entire Class C licenses for the state of Oregon, and I know I don't have any more of that same stuff out there. So, but we are finding things and getting them done as we go forward. Our security plan will be done in mid-2017. Vulnerability management, we're also hoping to get done mid-2017. Development is ongoing, and scanning's already being put in place for large agencies. That's the inside outlook. That's putting a probe or a device or a Nessus scanner inside, looking at the wire. So you're already behind the firewall. What is it that they got? What can you get into? And then the Center of Excellence, assuming passage of Senate Bill 90, our office will move to implement the full IT unification and cybersecurity Center of Excellence. So that's really what we're hoping.
So I would like to say that a lot of these are happening by probably before we get out of here for the end of session. So this particular slide, I'd probably like to have an update on this just before we leave.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Sure. Senator Riley, members of the committee, just want to remind the committee of the 2016 Senate Bill 1538. Senator Riley's very familiar with that. It's part of one of the bills that's before his committee, Senate Bill 120. It compels all agencies from all three branches to notify the Legislative Fiscal Office of any information security assessment that is done and or any information security incident that occurs. It also requires some annual reporting from the leaders of those organizations. And so I do fully intend to have that first annual report later in the session, probably in mid to late May. And we'll have folks from the Secretary of State, the Treasurer, the Attorney General's office, the state CIO, folks from Judicial Department and Legislative Administration come forward and give us an overview, give you all an overview of their information security posture.
Assuming that bill goes through as planned.
Sure. Well, they're already compelled to do that under Senate Bill 1538, but there may be some changes.
Yes.
On the other. Yeah.
And to that point, the executive order that unifies IT cybersecurity across the agencies is set to expire June the 30th of 2017. All right, so the internal Nessus scans are going on, the profiles, the NIST-based profile of agency security postures being developed, IT infrastructure, evaluations of IT technical practices, architecture and infrastructure, external app scan, that's really the big thing we're doing right now is walking the perimeter and making sure that what an attacker could see. Right, and so we call that perimeter scanning. So we're walking the Class Cs and figuring out what's there and seeing what other people can see of us. The security assessments, assessment of all the applications, that's going to take a little longer, and then how we're dealing with how agencies deal and how with classified data, level 4 data. So those are the things we're doing. Emphasis on the external app scan and the internal Nessus scan. And then really the others catch as catch can right now, you know, with the amount of time we have available to us between now and the end of June, that those are really the things that we think are those are the things that get us hacked, right? So I tried to find a dumpster fire picture, but I couldn't find one.
Yeah.
Despite 11 IT security audits in the last decade focused solely on the security of the state data center, the IT security posture of the state of Oregon remains fundamentally inadequate. As stated in the audit, overall agency planning efforts were often perfunctory, security staffing was generally insufficient, and critical security functions were not always performed. Given widespread underinvestment in IT security, persistent breaches, and agency noncompliance with existing security statutes and policies, the state of Oregon requires a new approach. While comprehensive IT security standards are certainly important, they're clearly not self-executing. So that's really where Senate Bill 90 originated from, was trying a different model. And we've been told from folks in industry, folks in other governmental entities, that unification of the security is really the direction that, you know, we no longer have the security in the world to say that, or the comfort in the world to say, if your neighbor's house is burning, it doesn't affect you. It does affect us. So we have to come together as a community, and that's really what we're trying to do now. Now, the vendor management, this is Basecamp, so there's the URL, and I'll give you have the copy of the presentation. Creating the vendor management, because of the explosion, as you see, in contractors and outsourcing, vendor management is really a big, big part, if not the future of IT in the state of Oregon. And we have to get in front of that, and we have to start managing our vendors comprehensively. It's no longer sufficient for us to have agency by agency determine what it is that they're going to buy from whom and have their individual SLAs and what have you. As we're seeing over and over again, changes or things that one agency does or relationships that one agency has with a vendor could affect things that other agencies have. And moreover, we don't do a good job, consequently, of leveraging all the things that we do with a single vendor. So we've allowed ourselves to become kind of, as we like to refer to them, as silos of, or cylinders of excellence is how we like to talk about them. And so as a consequence, it gives us, it leaves us at as a disadvantage as a state. And this is kind of our roadmap here. So our program got staffed in August of last year, and then all the green things are things that haven't been done. I'm not going to read all these to you. Really looking forward. We've got our outreach, our government partners outreach event coming up. One of the things that's very exciting is how many school districts, how many counties, how many municipalities have reached out to us. In the many small governmental organizations do not have the resources, the manpower, the people to know or to be able to design for themselves an architecture, an IT architecture, something that's cohesive, something that will work together for them. So what this will do is we're creating what we call a technology reference model, as I've presented before to this committee, identifying or articulating products and things that work well together in different domains, whether it be in compute, in storage, in security, in what have you, and recommending that reference model to those smaller entities to be able to, and contracts to execute from, state contracts to execute from, so that when they're looking for something that, yes, this will work with this gear, this equipment, so they don't have to research it themselves or try to miniaturize what the city of Portland is doing or something like that. So, you know, that's really what the whole, what one of the big benefits to this project is for us and for the state. So I think that's my last slide, isn't it? Yep.
All right. Questions? Yes,
Senator Chair Moore. Riley, Dr. Pettit. So your recommendations of what you would need, specifically the building that's half been finished and the leases you have and what the timing would be to finish that corresponding to the leases we're doing, are you asking for money to finish the building?
Chair Riley, Senator DeBoer, thank you for the question. No, we are not asking for the money. What we wanted to do is say this is what we've sought, this is what we're looking at. We are in a down budget year. We're appreciative of that. And what I said, I stand by, which is that over the next two years, 4 years, my intention is to piece part that together in some way so that I can get that. Now, I don't know how I'm going to do it exactly, sir, but that's my intent, is I'll buy one piece here and another piece there and try to cobble it together as best that I can with what resources I'm given, because it is a high priority to get those services stood up. No, I'm not asking for that. That's not in the governor's budget at this time. It's not in the governor's budget.
So as a follow-up, I would be interested in hearing your recommendations. You seem to understand finances and money and having a building partially completed and perhaps savings. It may be economical for the state to move forward on finishing a building. Sometimes empty buildings or half-empty buildings have more problems than a busy one. And you know when your leases expire, and I assume that you've got a plan about how to step out of the leases when you finish a portion. So I'd be interested in hearing, especially as we use bonding or financing. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Dr. Pettit. I think that does it. And Sean, what are we doing next?
Sure. So Co-Chair Riley, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, we're scheduled to reconvene next week, Thursday at 1 o'clock. We will have, as Dr. Pettit mentioned, we'll have some of his staff, his strategic technology officers in the areas of education, natural resources, and possibly one other program area. It'll depend on whether or not we have another Let's Live concept to introduce next week, but that's what's on the docket. We'll make sure to post the agenda likely tomorrow, and then materials probably early next week for you, and I'll, as per usual, I'll make sure to notify you and your staff when those materials are posted.
Right. Anything for the good of the order? We're adjourned. We're adjourned. Good of the order?